last together. We traveled back to the end of the first century to what is today Western Turkey, to the significant port city of Smyrna. Smyrna was one of the seven churches of Asia Minor to which the resurrected Jesus sent a letter by the hand of the Apostle John. Now, of all the cities that were mentioned in Revelation, Smyrna was considered to be one of the loveliest. It was referred to as the ornament of Asia, not only because of its wealth, being that it was a trade city known for its commerce throughout the Roman world, but also because of its beauty. Its beauty was unmatched by any other. The historian and commentator William Barclay writes that the city began at the harbor and traversed the narrow foothills, and then behind the city there rose the Pagos, the hill covered with temples and noble buildings which were spoken of as the crown of Smyrna. Apparently, as you came into the harbor by ship, the city in the distance with its magnificent towers and gleaming white temples and buildings resembled like a gigantic crown set upon the green hills in the Turkish countryside. Apparently, it was a magnificent sight to behold. In fact, the city itself boasted one of the most famous streets in the ancient world. It was a wide-set street called the Street of Gold. It was this beautiful marbled thoroughfare which wound around the cities, past schools of medicine and gymnasium and temples and monuments of every description. Now, apparently, the Smyrnans were so proud of their city that even on their silver coins that they used to buy and sell, those coins came with an inscription on the back that said, "First of Asia in beauty and in size." And that's what Smyrna was. It was the first of Asia. And yet, isn't it interesting that the Lord Jesus, when he begins to talk to this to the Christians in that city, isn't it interesting how well he knows it? Because when Jesus introduces himself to this church struggling for its very life, he begins by saying, "These are the words of him who is the first and the last." In other words, hey Smyrna, you might think that you are the first of Asia, but I am the first and the last. I am the sovereign God from eternity. This tiny church undergoing such hard times would have immediately recognized and understood what Jesus meant by that introduction. And they would have taken encouragement from it. For I think it bears remembering that whatever wonders that human beings in their arrogance and pride can create are really nothing in comparison to the power and the beauty and the eternality of Jesus. You might think you're something special, Smyrna, but I was here long before you showed up, and I'll be here long after you're gone. The first of Asia? Meet the first and the last from eternity. Not only does Jesus know about their civic pride, he knows their history. See, Smyrna hadn't always been the beautiful city that it was during the time of John. Apparently, the earliest beginnings of this city began around 1000 BC. It began as a Greek colony, but long about 600 BC, the Lydians came in and completely destroyed it. And for 400 years, Smyrna was nothing more than a pile of ruins and crabgrass, until it was finally rebuilt into the palatial city that was made famous. The citizens of Smyrna actually used to say that Smyrna was the resurrection city. a city that had died and then had literally, quite literally, resurrected to new life, to become the crown of Asia. And yet, how does Jesus introduce himself as the one who actually died and came to life again? And this has always been the great message of Christianity from the very beginning. This is the message that we preach. It is the reality for which the believers in Smyrna were suffering. This is why, when pressured to burn incense at the altar of the Caesars, these Christians refused. They refused to call Emperor Lord and God. Why? Because the resurrection of Jesus Christ is proof to the world that there is only one God who deserves our worship. And he is not the gods that we create for ourselves, but the God who proved his deity by dying and coming back to life again. This is who Jesus is. You see, the resurrection, ladies and gentlemen, is more than just that thing that we celebrate on Easter. The resurrection is really the dividing line between us and the world. Between we who worship the true God and this collection of modern-day false gods that our pagan neighbors and friends worship. Do you realize that even in our own culture, in our modern-day culture, there are all kinds of gods, right? Gods to the God, you know, there are gods of sport, the gods of sex and gambling, the gods of wealth and pleasure, the gods of luxury and popularity. All kinds of gods in our culture, if you just take the time to look at them. And this is one reason the world has hated us from the beginning. And why it continues to hate us. Because when we shine the light of the resurrection of Jesus on the world, we become to them a reflection that the gods that they're worshiping are no gods at all. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but the world doesn't like being told that the gods that they're worshiping are no gods at all. I remember one time I was teaching in the jail ministry, and in the information that we were giving them it was a substance abuse class, and in one of the things it talked about the fact that there is only one true God, and this one young woman was incensed by that. She says, "How dare you say there's only one God?" I mean, she was hot. How can you say this? She was mad. And I kind of backed up a little bit, and then all of a sudden I'm thinking, wait a minute. I said, the only reason you are saying this is because you're in rebellion against the true God. There is only one God. And how do I know that? Because Jesus Christ is the only one who died and rose again. And yet, I can't imagine a message more offensive to the current culture that we're in than the idea that there is only one God and only one way to get there, and that is through Jesus Christ. That is a message that is offensive to the world in which we're living. How dare you say that? Is their attitude. Because don't you realize that there are many, you know, there's many paths to get to God, many ways to get to heaven. No, there isn't. Jesus said, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. No man comes unto the Father except through me. And I know that because he died and rose again. When we shine the light of the resurrection of Jesus on the world, we're ultimately going to face some form of persecution. because our culture has been so indoctrinated by the political correctness of our age, by the syncretistic view that one religion is as good as the next. So having the effrontery to suggest that there is only one true God is seen as arrogance and dangerous fanaticism. In our culture, you are a dangerous person if you believe that your way, the way through Jesus, is the only way. And yet the resurrection of Jesus continues to scream out into the darkness. The gods you are worshiping are no gods at all. And that's why the gathering storm of persecution, in whatever form it may take, has come to the doorstep of the church. It has always come. And it may come to your doorstep if you are bold enough to preach it to your friends and to your family. But the real issue is this. Will these beleaguered believers in Smyrna persevere under the pressure of persecution? Or will their faith finally give way? That's a good question to ask ourselves as well. If your faith were put under pressure, the pressure of persecution right now, would it survive? Would you persevere? Well, how do we do that? How do we persevere under persecution? How do we survive the pressure cooker, as it were, of persecution? Or to put it another way, how does a persecuted Christian persevere to the end without giving up or giving in? Well, what we've identified seven things in this passage that you need to remember in the midst of persecution. You know, maybe you haven't been persecuted. Maybe you're not experiencing that right now. But listen, it's coming. That's why we call it the gathering storm. When the gathering storm finally arrives at your doorstep, how do you ensure that you can face it without giving in? Well, we said, first of all, we found from verse 8 that you needed to remember who Jesus is. This is why Jesus introduces himself. These are the words of him who is the first and the last, who died and came back to life again. You see, when persecution hits, there is the temptation to revert to the old pagan belief about God. And that is that bad things happen because God simply wasn't able, he wasn't strong enough to keep it from happening. The ancients believed that, you know, say when two armies met in battle, the one who lost did so not because their army was stronger or their general was a better tactician, but because the God leading them was not strong enough to defeat the God of the victor. Maybe there were those in Smyrna who were thinking, you know, this is happening to us. Maybe Jesus isn't the God I thought he was. But Jesus assures his people that this is not the case. Persecution has not come because Jesus is powerless to do anything about it. No, keep in mind who Jesus is. He is the first and the last. He is the Alpha and the Omega, the sovereign, eternal God from eternity, and he is the one who is for us. And if God be for us, then who can be against us, right? He is the one who was dead and came back to life again. If that kind of a God is on your side, what do you have to fear from men? You have nothing to fear from the power of men or nations, church. So when hard times come, remember who your God is. Okay? And you'll be able to persevere. Well, that's the first thing. Let's go on to the second. If you're going to persevere in times of persecution, you need to remember that when you suffer, he suffers with you. When you suffer, Jesus suffers right along with you. Notice what he says. I know your afflictions and your poverty. Now, it would be impossible for me to describe all the things that these Christians were enduring because of their love for Jesus. The Lord describes them as afflictions, you notice. In Greek, this word describes this unrelenting burden that crushes down upon you, that you carry along with it. And in a sense, it carries along with it the idea of a deep-seated personal anguish. So it's not just a burden that crushes in upon you, but it's also something that deeply affects you emotionally. And this is what these people were experiencing. In other words, these believers were being crushed under the weight of unrelenting persecution that never let up. A persecution that showed itself in every situation in which they found themselves. When they went to the marketplace, when they went to their places of business, in the midst of their own family relations, in a million different situations that touched their lives, in a million different ways, wherever they went, whatever they did, these believers were under constant threat, constant pressure to submit to a pagan culture that surrounded them. And I imagine it was to be kind of like being in a concentration camp, as it were. A concentration camp kind of atmosphere where fear and the looming threat of torture and death is always with you. I've seen documentaries of what goes on in North Korea. And they talk about the fact that in North Korea, simply by saying one thing or complaining about the regime of Kim Jong-un can get you thrown into a work camp, but it's a concentration camp. You and everybody who was ever associated with you. I mean, this is what happens to the enemies of the regime. They're tortured, they're starved, they're worked to death. There's no hope of ever getting out. This is where they are. That was kind of the atmosphere that these folks were enduring. But see, here's the kicker. All of that could have ended had they just submitted. Had they just burned incense to the altar of the emperor and said that the Caesar is both Lord and God, but they weren't willing to do that. They held fast to their love for Jesus, and many in their number had already paid the ultimate price. Not only were these people living under the constant pressure of persecution, but their loyalty to Jesus was affecting their bottom line. You notice what he says in that passage. He says, not only do I know the afflictions, the weight of pressure, the weight of persecution you're under, he says, but I also know your poverty. Persecution had so influenced them that it was actually affecting their personal finances. I know your poverty. Now, most scholars believe that the Lord was alluding to, what he was alluding to is the fact that because of their faith in Jesus, the local government was curtailing these believers in their ability to make a living. Perhaps they were prohibited from buying and selling what they needed in order to live in the marketplace. Can you imagine walking into a place, a grocery store or whatever it was, and say, I want to buy this to feed my hungry family? And then saying, where's your slip? Where's your certificate? See, you had to burn incense to the emperor, call him Lord and God. And if you did that, then they'd give you a certificate. So you go in, you're going to buy some food. Where's your certificate? I don't have it. Sorry, no food for you. Or perhaps you, as a merchant, no one would buy from them because they were Christians. Because they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't burn incense to the emperor. Perhaps they even started going hungry. I know your poverty, says Jesus. Perhaps even their kids were forced to go hungry simply because mom and dad wouldn't do it. They wouldn't burn incense to the emperor. The pressure to conform, the pressure to submit to the surrounding pagan culture must have been overwhelming. Can you imagine some of the, I can just imagine some of the conversations that were going on between these believers and some of their unbelieving relatives who would say, you know what, let's just go and do it. Just go and do it. Just run down to the temple. You can get it done within 5 minutes. All you got to do is burn a candle and say a few words. You don't even have to mean it. You just have to go. Burn a candle, light a candle, say a few words, and it's over. I can't do that. I won't do that. I will not deny my Lord. Fine. Then go hungry. Fine. Then you're fired. Fine. Then experience and enjoy prison. Put yourself in their place, beloved. You know, if we look at this scene and in our heads just freeze frame it for just a minute. Freeze frame it. I can't help but ask the question, how much undeserved pain and suffering would we be willing to endure simply because we love Jesus? How big of a weight are you willing to live under because of your faith? Honestly, I don't know if there's an answer for that question unless you're in that kind of situation. You might do a Peter and say, you know, oh yeah, I'd die for you, Jesus. And then, you know, when you're facing the suffering, discover that, like Peter, you're not quite as strong as you thought you were. Experience is a brutal teacher, said C.S. Lewis. But you learn. My goodness, you learn. But perhaps that's not the question that we should be focusing on. Perhaps it's this. Where do you find the strength to endure this kind of affliction without giving up or giving in? The answer is found in that little word in the text where Jesus says, I know your afflictions. And when Jesus says that he knows their afflictions, he's not just simply saying that he knows about them. He's not saying, hey guys, you know, I'm aware of the fact that you're suffering, but you know, come on, suck it up. That's not the attitude. Ever, you know somebody who kind of, you know, yeah, I know what's going on, but that's about as far as their interest level goes, right? Someone who knows what's going on but isn't necessarily predisposed to do anything about it. It's like that whole scandal that hit the Today Show, you remember, with Matt Lauer, right? And it came out that everybody, a lot of people in that whole organization knew what was going on. They were aware of it. But they weren't really necessarily plan on doing anything about it. They knew about it, but they weren't predisposed to doing anything. That's not what Jesus is saying here. He is not saying, yeah, I'm aware, don't bug me. No, but what he means by no is that word no is a word that goes way deeper than just being aware of something. When he says, I know, he means that he's personally acquainted with what is going on in their life. That when it was going on, Jesus was there when it was happening. That to me is a tremendous encouragement, don't you think? Beloved, when we suffer, don't we long to have a friend that comes up alongside us and says to us, hey, buddy, you know, I know what you're going through. I know that you're hurting. I've been there too. I'm here for you. Don't you want that? Don't we crave that? Absolutely. There's nothing worse than being in the midst of a storm of suffering and to feel like we're going through it all alone. This is part why God gives us the church, a church family. We need to be there for one another. We need to open our lives up to one another. There may be people that are here hurting, but we're not predisposed to sharing it with anybody. We ought to. We ought to. There's nothing worse than being in the midst of a storm and feeling all alone. But, and perhaps this is kind of where, this may have been where some of these Christians in Smyrna were, who were on the verge of giving in to the pressure that they were under, giving in to the persecution. And then a letter arrives from John, just in the nick of time. A letter addressed to specifically to them and to their situation. I know your afflictions. Have you ever had that happen? Maybe it was when you're flipping through the Bible and all of a sudden, boom, you know, verse pops out at you. I mean, it's a message just for you. Or you listen to the radio and somebody says something and it just goes right to the heart of you. Or a song comes on that speaks right to where you are. And it's not just that you've heard this, but it's not that you haven't heard it before, but it seems like the Lord knew exactly what you were dealing with and shows up kind of like a letter from John right at the moment that you need it, saying, I know your afflictions. I know what you're going through. I know your affliction. I mean, listen, those words are the words that these suffering people had so needed to hear. Jesus hadn't abandoned them. He hadn't left them to soldier on alone. He was right there with them the whole time. When you suffer, and I know that none of us like to suffer. I don't like suffering. But listen, when you do, you need to understand that God is right there going through it with you. This is why I don't understand when I know we tend to get angry at God. Well, why is this happening to me? As though God is somehow 150 miles away from your situation. No, I know your afflictions because I'm right there with you. I know your affliction. There is so much hope. There is so much love. There is so much encouragement, intimacy, and power in those words. Because you see, I've learned this about suffering. That when we suffer, God just doesn't know about it. He's not just aware of what's going on. He comes to sit with me. And that knowledge infuses the human soul with a supernatural strength that cannot be explained. All along, we should have known this because the Bible has clearly told us in its pages about the Lord and hardship. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who, listen, are crushed in spirit.